From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, educating all kinds of minds, we talk with Dr. Mel Levine, one of the country's leading experts on how children learn. He says that every mind works differently, and that standardized testing and teaching run counter to our mind's biology. His new book is called A Mind at a Time. Also, we meet Mary Wells Lawrence. From the 1960s to the 1980s, Lawrence was responsible for many memorable commercials, including Alka-Seltzer's Plop Plop Fizz Fizz and New York City's I Love New York. Her new memoir is A Big Life in Advertising. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The FBI director predicts that suicide bombers will eventually walk into public places in the U.S. the way they've done in the Middle East. Robert Mueller made that warning in a speech today in Virginia. At the Pentagon, military officials say they have not eliminated the al-Qaeda network's ability to strike. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Pentagon officials say that enemy fighters in Afghanistan have scattered. Only occasionally do small groups fight Allied forces. One of the rare occasions came over the weekend when enemy fighters killed an American soldier, and the U.S. says it killed at least one of the enemy. Yet, though al-Qaeda may be struggling in its one-time headquarters, Pentagon spokeswoman Tori Clark says the group still has the power to retaliate.
We believe we have made it more difficult for them to do business. But clearly, you just look at the kind of organization it was. There are still elements there that can and want to do harm to the United States.
At the same time, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee warns that al-Qaeda might not be the only enemy. Florida Democrat Bob Graham warns that groups like Hezbollah, which normally focus on Israel, could also strike the U.S. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has fired four of his cabinet ministers, a move that could reduce his control over parliament to a narrow majority. The four cabinet members belong to Sharon's coalition partner, the ultra-Orthodox Shas Party. Sharon was angry because the four voted against an economic package that he wanted to help deal with the government's deficit. If Shas Party delegates decide to retaliate by leaving the coalition, Sharon would be left with only 65 seats in the 120-member parliament. A car bombing killed a senior military commander of a radical Palestinian group in Beirut today. The group, led by the victim's father, Ahmed Jabril, is blaming Israel and vows retaliation. NPR's Kate Seeley is in Beirut.
Jihad Jabril died instantly when his car exploded in West Beirut. The 38-year-old Jabril was a senior commander of military operations in Lebanon for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command. The Damascus-based group, which is headed by his father, Ahmed Jabril, has long opposed any peace settlement with Israel and is on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations for its attacks on Israelis. No one has claimed responsibility for the car bombing, but the senior Jabril blamed it on Israel. He said Israel's intelligence agency Mossad had finally succeeded in killing his son. A comrade of Jihad vowed retaliation, although Israel has denied any connection to the car bombing. Jihad Jabril will be buried in Damascus on Wednesday. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 123 points, more than 1%, to close at 10,229. The Nasdaq lost 39 points. This is NPR News. Britain's Ministry of Defense said today that the Marine General in charge of British troops in Afghanistan will be replaced next month. The announcement that Brigadier General Roger Lane will be moved to a staff job came amid complaints that Lane had mishandled British operations in Afghanistan. British newspaper accounts said that Lane argued with U.S. commanders over strategy and lost the confidence of his own officers and men. Harvard biologist Stephen Jay Gould has died. Gould was a noted evolutionary biologist and a prolific writer. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
Stephen Jay Gould joined the faculty at Harvard University in 1967. He was an eclectic thinker, writing on topics as varied as geology and baseball statistics. He was a fierce defender of evolutionary theory, although some of his work broke with traditional notions laid down by Charles Darwin of how evolution worked. Gould suggested that evolutionary change occurred not gradually, but in a series of sudden jumps. Gould was as at home in front of a public audience as he was speaking to scientists. He wrote numerous books for a general audience, including Ever Since Darwin and Hen's Teeth and Horse's Toes. His latest book, The Structure of Evolutionary Theory, was published earlier this year. Gould died of cancer at his home in New York City. He was 60. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Historian Walter Lord has died at his home in New York City. He was 84. Lord was best known for his best-selling book on the sinking of the Titanic, A Night to Remember, which was published in 1955. Lord created the narrative by weaving together the stories of some 60 people who survived the disaster when the luxury liner struck an iceberg in 1912. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. This is what lies at the core of Dr. Mel Levine's philosophy of education. No kid should ever feel stupid in school. Levine is a professor of pediatrics at the University of North Carolina Medical School in Chapel Hill. He studies how children learn, and he says that while every mind works differently, our schools tend to use a one-size-fits-all approach to teaching. As a result, a lot of kids fall through the cracks. Levine is the co-founder and co-director of a nonprofit institute, All Kinds of Minds, which trains teachers and parents in identifying why a child is struggling in school and what they can do to help. In his new book, One Mind at a Time, Levine breaks learning down into 8 neurological processes: memory, language, spatial ordering, sequencing, motor skills, attention, social thinking, and higher thinking. I asked Mel Levine to give an example of a child having a problem with sequencing.
The teacher says, "Okay, class, can you open your books to page 14 and copy down those new words? And then I'd like you to turn to the end of the chapter and answer the 2 questions at the top of the page. Then close your books, put down your pencils, and sit up straight so I'll know you're finished." Michael heard something about a pencil, but he doesn't process sequences of information. He's also confused about time, doesn't quite know the months of the year and the days of the week, has trouble remembering to do things in the right order when he solves a math problem, may have difficulty narrating an experience he had and getting the results in the right order. And so anything that involves preserving a particular order confuses this child.
So he'd just hear that list of instructions and like deer in a headlight freeze.
Exactly. At home, his parents have noticed the same thing. "Hey, Michael, why don't you go put out the trash and then come back and pour yourself a glass of milk and put your pajamas on and come on and watch TV with us." 20 minutes later, what happened to Michael? He's walking around half naked in the kitchen. The dog is following him. Couldn't handle the sequence.
Now, how about higher thinking? What do you mean by that?
Higher thinking, in many ways, is our most sophisticated level of attainment. It includes things like the ability to really and truly understand concepts, like the concept of liberalism or the concept of photosynthesis or the concept of irony in a story. And by being able to solidify concepts in your mind, education for you will have much less emphasis on rote memory. You'll be able to compare and contrast things. You'll be able to really enjoy and appreciate the flow of ideas in school rather than feeling you just have to kind of absorb and regurgitate them.
So this is the real meat of knowledge.
This is the meat. This is the essence. And you'd be astounded at how many students don't quite ever attain this and don't know they're not attaining it, and their teachers are unaware of it.
Now, how do the different parts of the mind, as you define them, these parts, work together? Is it like an orchestra? Do you have a conductor?
Absolutely. And by the way, the conductor is called attention. The attention controls. And it's very much like an orchestra. In fact, one of the things we're trying to teach teachers to do and also clinicians to do is to look at different academic tasks and figure out the composition of the orchestra. In other words, what functions are required to solve a word problem in math? What functions are required to make friends and be able to keep friends? What functions are needed to write a report in fourth grade? What aspects of memory? What components of language? What kinds of sequencing and other organizational functions are going to have to be brought together to to play that piece of music, so to speak. And then if there's a child who can't do something, for example, she can't do word problems, we can say, where's the breakdown occurring? In other words, which member of the orchestra didn't show up?
Now, you break attention down into a number of different components, too. And I guess my question is, what is a kid like who has weak attention control? And are these the kids that we call ADD or often get labeled ADD?
They often get labeled ADD. I and my colleagues don't label anyone anything. We don't use terms like LD or ADD because we feel they don't really capture the essence of a child. They oversimplify kids. And also, they result in misdiagnosis all the time. For example, if you have trouble understanding language in the classroom, aren't you going to stop paying attention? And everybody's going to say you have ADD and miss the point that you really had difficulty keeping up with the tumultuous tide of language all day long in the classroom. And so we much prefer to be much more specific. And by the way, the other problems that occur with labeling is that labels never take into consideration your strengths. And of course, what really counts when you grow up is how strong your strengths are.
So where does that leave Ritalin in this conversation?
Well, in a sense, we can still use medication appropriately if we really understand the child and understand where his breakdowns are occurring. And we would say medication wouldn't be used to sort of cure ADD. It would be used to strengthen the attention controls.
Why don't you tell us what the different forms of attention are?
There are 14 different controls of attention. It's like a great control panel up in your mind, and they play a role, at least some of them do, in absolutely everything you do as a kid and also as an adult in a career and in everyday life. We divide the attention controls into three areas. One is mental energy control, and mental energy control just gives you the fuel you need to get things done, to do things you don't feel like doing, to concentrate, to exert mental effort. And mental energy control also involves your ability to turn off the flow of mental energy so you can fall asleep at night and to turn it up high during the day so you can be tuned in and effortful and effective throughout your day at school or at work. So the balance between sleep and wakefulness is also part of the control of the flow of mental energy. And by the way, we see some children who have a lot of trouble sleeping at night and a lot of trouble functioning during the day. There are some adults like that as well.
So that's one of the ways in which you might diagnose this deficiency in this one part of attention.
Yes, and I can't emphasize enough that different children who have attentional problems have different combinations of weaknesses in the controls. It's not as if you've seen one, you've seen them all. There's tremendous variation. The second area of attention I like to call intake or processing control. It's your mind's ability to deal with information that's sort of right at your doorstep, ready to come into consciousness. And it's sort of cleaning up the data so you can use it, so you can remember it, so you can really understand it effectively. For example, one part of intake control is selection, or what we call saliency determination. Of all the information sort of competing for your consciousness, what's really important here? What's really salient? What should I tune into and what should I filter out? So when you're sitting in the classroom, you can listen to the teacher instead of looking out the window. And by the way, issues relating to what's important and what isn't important become some of the most common learning disorders of high school students. Knowing what to study for an exam, knowing how to take notes, and I can tell you so many teenagers whom I've seen with learning problems tell you, when I get to the end of a chapter, I have no idea what I've just read. Meaning they couldn't tease out relative degrees of saliency or importance. Everything was sort of a straight line, a blur for them. And that puts them tremendously at risk for failure.
Is this directly related to prioritizing also?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, I have to tell you one other interesting thing. I gave a workshop recently for a group of college professors, which I don't ordinarily do. And this was at a major university, and the dean of the law school was there. And when he heard me talk about saliency determination, about your ability to filter out what's unimportant and focus on what's important, he said that's probably, difficulty with that is probably the most common cause of dropout from law school. Law students who really look at a case and can't figure out what's relevant and what's irrelevant. And boy, do they dissipate in law school. Another one of the processing controls is once information sort of gets in through the gateway of consciousness, how deeply are you going to process it? How well will it take root in your mind? You know, we have an old expression in English, it went in one ear and out the other. That's called superficial processing, as opposed to deep enough processing, so it really takes hold. And there are some children who can't follow directions because they never really let anything get in far enough, so you have to keep repeating things to them. And interestingly enough, many individuals whose processing is superficial, where information doesn't get in very far, turn out to be phenomenal at seeing the big picture, at going through life with a wide-angle lens on, but they hate details.
So when you're confronted with a kid who is having some kind of trouble in school and
right.
ends up in your office, how do you tease out these very specific weaknesses in them? How do you evaluate them for them?
There are many different ways. First and foremost, someone trying to evaluate a child has to have some knowledge of what the possibilities are. You know, I'm a pediatrician, and in medicine we have something called differential diagnosis. If a child has a fever and a rash and she's 9 months old, what are the things I need to be thinking about? And we do the same thing when it comes to these learning issues. If a kid is 13 and still doesn't know his multiplication facts and is having a lot of difficulty in algebra, what are the things I have to be thinking about that might be causing that breakdown? And we look at samples of the child's work. We interview the child. You wouldn't believe, Barbara, how often a kid can tell you, if you ask the right questions, exactly where his breakdown is occurring. Tommy, do you have trouble understanding math or remembering it? He can say, oh, I always understand it when the teacher explains it. I could teach it to everybody else, and then I can't remember how to do it on the test.
Dr. Mel Levine is a developmental pediatrician. He's the director of the University of North Carolina's Clinical Center for the Study of Development and Learning. His new book is A Mind at a Time. We have a short break now, Mel, and then we'll talk some more.
Great.
This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Mel Levine. He's the director of the Clinical Center for the Study of Development and Learning at the University of North Carolina. His new book is A Mind at a Time. Let's talk about memory for a moment, because you write
sure.
in the book that often kids who get labeled learning disabled, or just plain called stupid by everyone,
exactly.
have very distinct memory deficiencies. Is that something easy to diagnose, or does it get overlooked in this labeling of LD, learning disabled, or ADD?
It's easy to diagnose, and it almost always gets overlooked. It's just extraordinary how many kids with memory difficulties are just not having their memory problems identified. And now that we know how to do these things, why aren't we recognizing them? And by the way, retaining a child in a grade does nothing to improve his memory.
So are there easy ways or very direct ways to compensate for a memory problem, strategies to improve memory once you pinpoint a deficiency? And is that something teachers should teach kids in school?
Absolutely. It's unbelievable how much memory is required in school and how we never bother to teach kids how memory works. In fact, I have a strong bias, and all of our programs do, that children ought to be learning about learning while they're learning, that part of learning ought to be learning how to work your mind. Otherwise, it's like driving a car without driver's ed. And we know so much about how learning works, but we're not telling the teachers and we're not telling the students.
Well, give us an idea of some of the tricks, the basic tricks that teachers could lay out for kids. And I was interested in one thing that you wrote, that the best way to remember something, say for a test, is to transform it. In other words, if something you're trying to remember is verbal, make it visual, make a diagram for yourself. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. That's one method, is keep recoding information. If it comes in visually, like a diagram, put it into words, describe it. If it comes in verbally, try to make a diagram of it, try to make a chart, try to picture it. try to think of examples of it in your own life. The more you extend information, the more you elaborate it, the more you modify it in one way or another, the more effectively it gets filed in memory. It's also important to teach kids that they need to put information in categories, that you don't put things in memory without attaching them to something. Let me give you an example that shows this. Long about age 9, children develop a filing system in their minds. They actually develop folders that they can put information in. If you ask a 7-year-old to name as many animals as he can in 30 seconds, he'll say robin, shark, cow, dog, spider. If you ask a 13-year-old with a well-organized memory to name as many animals as he can in 30 seconds, he'll say cow, chicken, turkey, pig, lion, tiger, giraffe, elephant, rhino, spider, ant, bee. Do you see what he's doing?
They put them in phylum in classes.
Yes, he's going from one folder to another. He can name 10 times as many animals as that 7-year-old. And if you see a 13-year-old and you ask him to name as many animals as he can in 30 seconds and he sounds like a 7-year-old, you know he's failing tests in school. He has no folders. He's got to be taught how to do that. And so often, what comes intuitively and naturally to certain kinds of minds has to be taught formally to other kinds of minds. Every single one of us has things that we can do so well intuitively and things that we're going to have to be led through formally.
There was a little trick that you wrote about in the book that I never thought of, that long-term memory filing works best right before you go to sleep.
Absolutely.
How would you apply that?
Well, kids have to know you study for exams right before you go to sleep, and by all means, do not study and then take a shower and then go to sleep, because then all you remember in the morning is the shampoo. You have to take the shower first and then study and then go to sleep. And what you study right before you go to sleep gets replayed about 5 times after you fall asleep. It has instant replay built into it. This is one of the many, many sort of memory tricks of the trade that I think students ought to know about. And in addition to that, you know, maybe everybody's memory works a little differently. So once you get a child or an adolescent started with the general advice, you can then charge him with the responsibility. And why don't you try to figure out how your memory works best, what things you need to do to prime your memory best.
Now, looking at how long-term memory works, is there a neurological argument against the typical organization of the school day, that you go from 45 minutes of math to 45 minutes of English to 45 minutes of social studies? Does that chopped-up day promote consolidation of learning, or does it just break up the flow?
There's no doubt about it that once information enters your mind, it needs some time to consolidate. I believe that after a 40-minute class session in school, the kids ought to get together in small groups to discuss what just went on, elaborate on it, change it in the ways I just described, and give it time to consolidate. If that doesn't happen, then social studies erases algebra, and Spanish erases social studies. Each class kind of deletes much of what went on during the class before.
So is there a neurological argument then for block scheduling?
Block scheduling is another option, that you would have a particular 2-month period, let's say, where you do mainly biology, and another 2-month period mainly for English, and so on. And by the way, I don't think that has to be extreme. You could say that it would be mainly biology, but you'll also be having some quick reviews of English and some small segments of other things just for booster doses. So one wouldn't have to totally let go of everything else, but one could have a strong central emphasis during each block.
So what systems of mind does our school system play to? Is it out of balance with our biology, our minds working?
I believe so. And I think in the most concrete way, I think school overutilizes memory. You know, at no point in life and almost no career that you can name do you need as much memory as you do in school, especially nowadays when your hard drive tends to be on your desk, so it doesn't all need to be intracranial. And I think schools have to realize, in the way they design tests, in the way they prepare students, that we don't want kids to come to think that learning is remembering, learning is regurgitation. And I think there's an imbalance now between understanding and remembering. And many students feel if they remember something, they understand it. I believe even some of the standardized high-stakes testing that's occurring across the country right now is perhaps placing too much emphasis on rote memory and not enough on insight and understanding. I don't think that's an incurable condition, but I think there's a tendency toward that right now.
Well, schools need tests. Kids need tests. How could they be better devised then to recognize the different ways that kids' brains work? Should kids be able to bring notes to tests, or many tests should include you're allowed to bring notes?
How's this, Barbara? Why don't we say you're going to have an hour test today? The first 20 minutes are without your notes, and for the last 40 minutes, I'd like you to take out your notes so that we're really explaining to kids. There's a certain amount of knowledge that you have to just plain know and store away, but then there's also something called understanding and judgment and brainstorming and critical thinking that we'd like you to move into.
You write a lot about the role of language in learning, that a lot of kids with language problems get misdiagnosed as having attention problems. How do you tell them apart?
I think there are a lot of ways we can tell attentional difficulties from language difficulties. For example, you may see that a child is having trouble concentrating, is really having trouble filtering out distractions and pacing himself and being able to stay tuned into the important details. But you may notice that only happens in highly verbal settings. He doesn't have that problem when he's playing his computer games. He doesn't have that difficulty when he's doing hands-on activities that involve a lot of visual input. But when it's pure language, you lose this child. Then you might be more apt to suspect a language problem than an attentional problem. And I hasten to add that it's possible to have both, to have trouble with attention plus language. But we try to sort those out as well as we can.
Dr. Mel Levine is the director of the University of North Carolina's Clinical Center for the Study of Development and Learning. His new book is A Mind at a Time. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Paradise Park by Allegra Goodman, author of Catterskill Falls. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, I can't believe I ate the whole thing. We talked to Mary Wells Lawrence about creating some of the most memorable advertising campaigns of the 60s and 70s. Her new memoir is A Big Life in Advertising. And we continue our conversation with Dr. Mel Levine about how children learn.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with Dr. Mel Levine. He teaches pediatrics at the University of North Carolina Medical School and is the co-founder and co-director of All Kinds of Minds, a nonprofit institute which develops programs to address learning differences in children. His new book is A Mind at a Time. When we left off, we were discussing how language problems often go undetected in kids at school and can really trip them up. I asked Mel Levine what parents and teachers can do to help.
There are a lot of different things. I think that whether we like it or not, schools are designed for linguists. In many ways, it's a shame because there are some wonderful kinds of minds that get destroyed by school because they think nonverbally. They visualize rather than verbalize all the time. And the adult world has endless numbers of jobs for people who are better at thinking without language. All the different technological fields. I can't tell you how many former patients of mine are now designing websites and engaging in other activities that involve really pre-visualizing things more than verbalizing. But we still have to worry about getting these kids through school and having them survive in that highly verbal universe called education. And so there's a lot of things that parents can do. For example, we know that during elementary school, the most important part of language is at the sentence level. That's when the brain really becomes increasingly efficient and precise in dealing with sentences, with the relationship between word order and meaning, with clauses inside of sentences, and therefore understanding directions, understanding explanations. There's just this highly accelerated development of sentence comprehension and sentence construction during elementary school. What does that mean? It means that every parent ought to be saying, in our home, we only talk in full sentences. We don't say stuff. We don't say thing. We don't use little phrases. We got to build those sentence muscles because you're 9 years old, and that's crucial. And every classroom teacher ought to be the same thing, be saying the same thing.
Boy, there'd be a lot of changes in my house.
Go for it. But, you know, if you think about it, sentences not only build language, they build logical thinking. Words like although, unless, until, instead of, aren't those the cornerstones of thinking logically and reasoning? And so every time you're building a sentence, you're also fortifying your rational thinking equipment.
So when you say demystify for the child what is holding him or her back in school, is the point of that that so much of the agony of school is that you feel dumb? And even if you're
Absolutely.
Not good, you're pretty great at 3 out of 4 subjects, but you're really bad at 1, you feel like a loser.
Absolutely. And there's so much misunderstanding, and so often children write themselves off. They think that what's wrong with them is so much worse than what's wrong with them. That they decide they were born to lose, that they may as well give up, that they may as well find other kids in town who feel the same way and band together and go to the mall on Saturday and ultimately get into drugs and get into trouble because they've written themselves off. The most horrible complication of learning difficulty in my mind is called pessimism.
What place, then, does this label learning disabled have in the educational system?
In my opinion, it's served its purpose, and it's time to move beyond the label of learning disabled. Because to most people, learning disabled means that a kid fits a particular formula that says that he's eligible for services, that he has a difference between his IQ and his achievement testing. And now that we know the broad array of learning problems that kids have, that makes no sense whatsoever. It's hard to know where to draw the line, what to include as a learning disability and what not to include. If a kid has trouble managing time, is that a learning disability? If a child does well academically but has trouble expressing himself when he talks, is that a learning disability? Are the attentional controls learning issues and weak attention controls therefore learning disabilities, or are they not? It's just silly. We really want to look at profiles of strengths and weaknesses. And we don't want kids to grow up feeling they're defective. We don't that they have a label. So I think we can help kids without labeling them, without testing them to see if we can help them. Can you imagine a person falling off a ship and beginning to drown, and we say, I'm sorry, we can't save you until you've had a swimming test? or we can't save you because we know you can't swim, but it's part of an overall gross motor problem. It's not a specific disability, so we can't save you. And that's what's going on, that kind of thinking in schools all the time. You have to be eligible according to some very narrow criteria for us to be able to even acknowledge that you're struggling with your wiring.
Well, someone might say, just to play devil's advocate, that sure. if every mind works so differently, how can we expect schools to address these myriad of varieties of learning deficits that you have to draw the line somewhere, and you have to have a test that separates, you know, a certain level of difficulty in struggling with school from another?
Well, let me address that in several different ways with you. First of all, we're really not saying that every single kid in a classroom has to be taught differently. That's not the case. There's a basic way, a basic sort of core way that we're addressing all of them. But we can individualize within that context as needed. For example, many children with sequencing problems hate to use cursive writing because it's such a complicated sequence. And they go up and tell you, I'd much rather print than do cursive. I hate cursive writing, and I do it too slow, and it's too hard for me. It doesn't really cost any money out of the school budget or drain any resources to say to that child, that's fine, why don't you just print for the rest of your life? If you know that a child has trouble with retrieval memory, and Barbara, when you're called on in class, you have 3 seconds to respond to a question, it really doesn't cost anything to say to the child, I'm going to call on you tomorrow to ask you about the causes of World War II. Can you be ready for that? So these are little accommodations, little aspects of flexibility that don't really mean you're teaching every single child differently, but it does mean you're willing to be somewhat flexible with every child.
But is it fair to the other kids, the kids who have to write cursive and who aren't given a fair warning of when they'll be called on in class?
I met a teacher recently who told me that she gets up in front of the class on the first day of class and looks out there and says, look here, kids, I want you to know one thing. I'm not treating any two of you alike this year. There's some of you who are going to write long papers and some of you shorter papers. Some of you are going to read longer stories and some of you shorter stories. She said, I don't intend to treat any two of you the same and you shouldn't want to be treated the same. And she set that up as the sort of ethos, as the way of thinking in her classroom, sort of celebrating diversity. And she said she does that every year and there's never any problem. She never hears another word out of any kid because that's the way her class works.
Mel Levine, thanks a lot for talking today on Fresh Air.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. Mel Levine, his new book is A Mind at a Time. He's the co-director of the All Kinds of Minds Institute based in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Coming up, a life in advertising. This is Fresh Air. Remember this classic commercial?
Well, you really did it to yourself this time. At least you remember the Alka-Seltzer.
Plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is.
Plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is.
Plop, plop,
Alka-Seltzer is just one of the unforgettable campaigns that Mary Wells Lawrence describes in her book, A Big Life in Advertising, about her 3 decades in the business. Her company, Wells Rich Green, was the first firm on the New York Stock Exchange run by a woman. Clients included Braniff Airlines, TWA, Benson & Hedges, Philip Morris, and Procter & Gamble. Before she started her own company, Lawrence worked on the Alka-Seltzer campaign at another agency, where a chemist on staff who was reading about the newly touted wonders of aspirin realized that 2 Alka-Seltzer might work better than 1. This doubled Alka-Seltzer's sales at the time and eventually led to the plop-plop idea. Lawrence started out in the 50s writing ad copy for department stores in Ohio and went on to get a job at McCann Erickson, a large New York firm in the 50s, where she was one of the only women account executives.
In those days, women handled accounts for women. Men handled accounts for the world. Men handled automobiles, for example, and they had Chrysler and General Motors at different times or whatever. But women handled things like Tampax, silverware, fiberglass, curtains, you know, materials. cosmetics. Women were supposed to work on products for women because they understood those products, because women were still not quite as accepted in business and certainly not even in the agency business as men.
The campaign that really made your career early on was for the then brand new Braniff Airlines. And you made this unknown airline hot news. What was the breakthrough idea in that campaign?
First of all, the airlines developed with the people running the airlines came out of the Army and the Navy. They came out of the Air Corps. They were not marketing people, and they didn't think in that way. And the airlines evolved in a kind of a gray world, a very practical, technical gray world. And we went all over the United States studying the different terminals, the stewardesses, the pilots, how they looked. The stewardesses, and they were called stewardesses then before they were called hostesses, and they were all dressed to look as if they could fly the planes. They looked as if the pilot had a heart attack, they could just step in and it would be okay. And they were all very reassuringly dressed, but certainly not dressed to be attractive or appealing. The airlines themselves were they were all gray. The insides were gray or brown. And the idea of color came to me kind of in a shock when I was standing in one terminal after having seen many of them. I suddenly had this kind of instant, miraculous idea that what if there were color here? Because there was no color whatever. And I could just see flooding the airline business with color. What a transformation that would make. And I also realized after studying color as we experimented with it on the planes that if you could get away, if you had the guts to paint the planes different colors, first of all, they would stand out on any field. You'd see them before you'd see any other plane. But you would also want to go see them. I mean, and people did. They used to drive out weekends to look at them after they'd been painted and they were appearing.
We have the Braniff TV commercial. Why don't we play that now?
Braniff International is creating the most beautiful airline in the world. We hired Emilio Pucci to design our uniforms. Our hostesses wear reversible coats of almond green and apricot, space helmets to keep out the rain, red space suits, and sometimes something a little more comfortable. And we hired Alexander Girard to do our planes. We have blue planes, orange planes, yellow planes. You can fly with us seven times and never fly the same color twice. Inside seven different color schemes. And since we fly to Mexico and South America, art from Peru, Brazil, and Argentina. Cha-cha-cha. Braniff International announces the end of the plane. We won't get you where you're going any faster, but it'll seem that way.
And now by the end of that spot, everyone, the stewardesses and the crew, are all assembled on the wing of a Braniff airplane. This idea of color and their kooky colors, and the stewardesses have these amazing spacesuit-like helmets in this ad. It's really out there. Did you do anything like market testing to get an idea or a reassurance that this idea would fly with the public?
No, we never tested anything. We didn't have time. So we just went with our instinct.
You started your own company in the mid-60s, Wells Rich Green. You had a different take on running an ad agency, you write in your memoir. You thought of it more like a motion picture company. What did that mean? What did you do differently?
Advertising was even on television, it looked very much like print that moved. It was extremely presentational. And I wanted to open an agency where, first of all, the goals would be much higher, would be much greater, that the creative people who were making the advertising would be the people who would be in direct contact with the clients and would be finding out the information and would be in a position to create a miracle. What I mean by that is a solution for a client that made a major difference at the end of the year in his financial structure, in terms of his sales, in terms of his success as a company. So we structured the agency completely differently. We structured it around the creative people. And I ran the business as though I were producing about maybe 15 movies at any given time, in that you had different groups of people doing different kinds of work at the agency. But each of them was supposed to develop something tremendously emotionally powerful that would make a major change in the outcome and the future of a business.
Now, the Alka-Seltzer campaign, Alka-Seltzer followed you to Wells Rich Green eventually, and you all came up with the famous "Try it, you'll like it," and also "I can't believe I ate the whole thing." We have to listen to that. We have that one. Let's play it.
I can't believe I ate that whole thing.
You ate it, Ralph.
I can't believe I ate that whole thing.
No, Ralph, I ate it.
I can't believe I ate that whole thing.
Take two Alka-Seltzer.
Alka-Seltzer neutralizes all the acid your stomach has churned out. For your upset stomach and headache, take Alka-Seltzer and feel better fast.
Did you drink your Alka-Seltzer?
The whole thing.
Now, this commercial won so many awards, and I think anyone over about 30 recognizes it immediately. When you first saw it in storyboard form, did you know right away that I Can't Believe I Ate the Whole Thing had tremendous potential?
Oh, yes. There were two of them at the time. There was I Can't Believe I Ate the Whole Thing, and there was another one with the line that said, "Try it, you'll like it." They were perfect commercials at the time because they... After having gone through a period of reintroducing Alka-Seltzer as a solution for many, many, many different discomforts, the world had gotten a little bit older. We were not in the 60s. By this time, we were in the late 70s, early 80s, and the world was older, and people were getting more obvious discomforts from overdrinking and overeating. And we wanted to come back and remind people of how effective Alka-Seltzer was for... overindulgence, but not in a way that suggested slobism, but in a sweet, entertaining, amusing, cool way, but that would never let you forget what actually Alka-Seltzer did, but would also smile you into liking the fact that you got these various conditions and that it was easy to cure them with Alka-Seltzer. Now, there had been very funny commercials done for Alka-Seltzer at a different agency before we got the account back. They were hilarious commercials. They were absolutely...
This is one spicy meatball, right?
That's right, exactly. They were very amusing, very entertaining. But the problem with them was, we think, looking back on them, because they didn't work, and we think the problem was that they were extreme. They were all about the humor. They were MTV funny at that time. They were very edgy humor, but they didn't really leave you feeling that what you were going to get from the product was relief. And I have always felt that humor in advertising is very powerful and it's wonderful. It's very friendly and extremely effective, but that it has to encompass something... some kind of information, some kind of idea about a product that makes you a little bit nervous if you don't buy the product, that makes you think you haven't gotten the best there is because the best would be this product. And when you have a funny commercial that doesn't tell you what to think, doesn't tell you what to do, doesn't tell you what to expect, where you don't feel that earnest belief in the product inherent in the humor, humor can be very damaging.
I'm talking with Mary Wells Lawrence. During her three decades in advertising, she was, among other things, the guiding force behind the campaigns for Alka-Seltzer, Benson & Hedges, and I Love New York. Her ad agency, Wells Rich Green, was the first company on the New York Stock Exchange run by a woman. Mary Wells Lawrence has a new memoir, A Big Life in Advertising. Mary, we'll talk more after a moment. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
back with Mary Wells Lawrence. In over 30 years in advertising, her clients included TWA, Alka-Seltzer, Philip Morris, and Procter & Gamble. She was the first woman CEO of a company listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Her new memoir is A Big Life in Advertising. Well, I'm thinking here you were the head of a company in a male-dominated, completely male-dominated field. But perhaps being a woman, you might have been perceived as not as threatening as a male CEO or a male executive. Did you have an edge in this department in terms of cultivating and keeping your clients?
Well, there are two different things there. One was that I worked hard at finding, at developing connections with my clients so that I understood them and we did things together or we could talk about things that they couldn't talk to other people about. So I became very good friends with them. And then there was the second aspect, which is that because I was a woman, we were dealing with the CEO of a company, and CEOs live a very lonely life because they are surrounded by people who are trying to get their jobs, and they're always keeping a little bit to their breast because they have, you know, this sense that people are trying to push them out the door and get them to retire and take over. And I was a female who could read their annual report and could talk about their financial reports and could talk about their dreams and what they're planning for the company and what they're planning for themselves. And they weren't threatened because I was a woman, which is, in a sense, sort of a sad issue, but still, it worked to my benefit. They told me everything.
Now, this, when you first started your company in the 60s and then built it up in the 70s, did you consider yourself a feminist at the time? That was really the height of the first feminist wave. Did you relate to them?
You know, people often ask that question. I have to honestly admit that I've never thought of myself as young, old, white, black, male, female, or anything else. I've always, the way I developed as a person just led me to become very simply a person in charge of an advertising agency, which was my passion. I really wasn't at any time caught up in any major issue. But what I think happened, and that I'm very proud of, is that in the process of running an agency the way men run an agency, and in having the success that men had, that I did it. You know, I mean, I did it. I didn't do it thinking that I was a feminist. I didn't do it thinking that I did it the way men do it.
I think male ad execs called you, what was it, Queen of the Black Widow Spiders? What was that all about?
They did. Well, you know, here you had an advertising industry that was very waspy. It was very very conservative. They were all members of a club. They all did things by a kind of agreement, mutual agreement. And into this atmosphere comes this young, blonde, heady girl who wants to do everything differently and doesn't attend your club meetings and doesn't show you the proper respect by kneeling and acts as though she can do it just as you can do it. And at the time, it was a shock. And I took a lot of business away from a lot of these fellas, and they didn't like it. And I kept, our agency was incredibly successful very fast, and they were quite angry. It went against the grain. I mean, people don't like to have their clubs upset and their communities upset and change. People don't like change. And I was the first symbol of, I was one of the first symbols of the youth movement changing the agency business, but I was also certainly the first element of female success that had entered the industry. And it wasn't taken well at all.
Well, I think you caught flack from also feminists. I know Gloria Steinem pilloried you as Uncle Tomming your way to the top. So you're getting it from both sides.
Yeah. Well, again, that never bothered me for half a minute. I just wasn't interested in the philosophy of what I was doing. I was interested in doing it and getting it done. And I was interested in being, in just being what the men had always been in the advertising business. I just didn't see any reason why I couldn't be just as successful as a woman doing the same things.
Well, you carried that into your personal life, too. You married Harding Lawrence, the founder of Braniff Airlines, and that was your first big campaign after the campaign was established, you married, and you had unusual living arrangements. He lived in Texas, where the airline was based, with your two daughters from your first marriage and his three children from his previous marriage, and you would live in New York and fly in on the weekends. You pretty much lived like a man, right?
Well,
by those standards, but of those days.
Yes, I guess so. I wasn't thinking of it that way either. It was what I wanted to do. I simply always did what I thought I really wanted to do. I mean, I wanted my children to have a family life, and I thought Dallas was a perfect place for that, and we built a beautiful home there. I wanted to be with my children and my husband, so I flew to them because it was better. I mean, I was trying to create a kind of a community life for them as well as a family life. And I was the one who could travel. I have tremendous energy. I've always had tremendous energy, much more than anybody I know really enjoys, because I make work. I make, you know, challenges. If there aren't enough, I go out and make them.
Mary Wells Lawrence. Her memoir is A Big Life in Advertising. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Also by the National Endowment for the Arts and Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback Ghost Soldiers, the epic account of World War II's greatest rescue mission by Hampton Sides. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tom Waits. The distinctive singer and songwriter has two new CDs, Blood Money and Alice. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
A foe.